92 amicus briefs filed in this case, which probably puts it in the top five of all time. 73 of them were filed in support of the University of Texas, and most and a couple of those are critical of our brief, including one signed by Professor Limpert and others, which he referenced earlier. But the Supreme Court has not seen this litigated throughout the process. There hasn't been adversarial testing of these arguments, and therefore it would be surprising to see the Supreme Court saying mismatch, therefore Fisher wins. They won't do that. I don't think they will do that. But it's possible that some justices aware of this evidence, aware that there's at least a debate, may be less inclined than they have been in the past to presume that, of course, racial preferences are an unqualified benefit to all of their recipients all of the time. That may seep into their thinking, whether or not it seeps into their opinion writing. In addition, it's quite possible the court will move the law in a direction that would alleviate harms to underqualified students, to mismatch harms, those admitted because of racial preferences, as well as harms to passed over well-qualified whites and Asians. A paraphrase from the last major affirmative action decision, the 2003 Grutter case involving University of Michigan Law School, helps explain this point. Justice O'Connor wrote that use of race as a factor in admissions is unconstitutional if it, and I think this is a quote, unduly harms any racial group. Well, it's the harm to passed over whites and Asians, which is presumably what she was mainly thinking about, is they didn't get into the school they wanted to. I happen to think that the harm most whites and Asians in that position suffer from not getting into their first choice school is less than the mismatch harms we're talking about, but that's probably debatable. But the what would increase harm? What is Justice O'Connor talking about, too much harm? Well, it's hard to think of what it would mean except unduly large preferences. The larger the preferences, the more well-qualified white and Asian students are passed over in order to make room for less well-qualified preferred classes. So the Supreme Court might consider whether large preferences are doing undue harm to whites and Asians. It just so happens that the harm done by preferences under mismatch theory to blacks and Hispanics is also attributable to their size. I don't think many people would seriously argue that a rather small racial preference, a tiebreaker preference, or a little more than a tiebreaker preference, would be harming its intended beneficiaries. But when the preferences are on the order of those at the University of Texas, which I'll mention in a minute, the question is rather different, and we've heard some of the evidence. So, for example, among freshmen entering the University of Texas at Austin in 2009, who were admitted outside the top 10% system, the mean SAT score on a 2400 scale of Asians was 467 points above the mean black score. The mean white score was 390 points above the mean black score. And those are pretty big differences in terms of percentiles or whatever. These are not tiebreakers, and they're not close to being tiebreakers. And if the Supreme Court decides that they're too large for one reason, if the Supreme Court may decide they're too large because they're excluding too many well-qualified whites and Asians, it would have what I think to believers in the mismatch theory is the happy effect of reducing the harms, reducing the size of the preferences, and thus reducing the harms to the blacks and Hispanics, the mismatch problem. With that, I'll introduce our panelists in the order in which they're going to speak. And we have a very qualified panel who can, and I've invited them to talk about any aspect of this broad subject that's on their mind, whether or not it relates directly to what's been said before. The first to speak will be Richard Collenberg. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about a variety of education issues. He's been called the intellectual father of the economic integration movement in K-12 schooling and arguably the nation's chief proponent of class-based affirmative action in higher education admissions. He's also an authority on teachers' unions, private school vouchers, charter schools, turnaround school efforts, inequality of higher education, and many other things. Richard is the author of 5 books, and the only one I'll mention now, in interest of brevity, is 2. All Together Now, Creating Middle-Class Schools Through Public School Choice, Brookings Institution Press, 2001, and The Remedy, Class, Race, and Affirmative Action, Basic Books, 1996. The second to speak will be Glenn C. Lowry, who was introduced earlier, but for those who weren't here, I'll briefly reprise a little bit of the introduction. He's the Merton P. Stoltz Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at Brown University. He's taught previously at Boston, Harvard, and Northwestern Universities, University of Michigan. He holds a BA in Mathematics, Northwestern, a PhD in Economics, MIT. Professor Lowry is a distinguished academic economist who has contributed to a variety of areas in applied microeconomic theory, welfare economics, game theory, industrial organization, natural resource economics, and economics of income distribution. He's also lectured before academic societies throughout the world. Professor Phil Richards the Arnold Sayo Chair of Diversity and Community in the Department of English at Colgate University. He has written 2 books, Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African American Letters, A Critique of the Reigning Hegemony in African American Literary Studies, and most recently, An Integrated Boyhood, Coming of Age in White Cleveland. He has written literary journalism about race and education in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Dissent, Commentary, Harper's, the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education, and the Massachusetts Review. And if anybody else has an as eclectic a collection of outlets as that, I'd like to hear who it is. Peter Schmidt is senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he covers affirmative action and has covered education research. He's also author of the critically acclaimed Color and Money, How Rich White Kids Are Winning the War Over College Affirmative Action, published in 2007 by Palgrave Macmillan St. Martin's Press. Schmidt came to the Chronicle from Education Week, where he was a staff writer, and his reporting has earned him numerous awards from the National Education Writers Association and other journalistic organizations. I've asked each of our speakers to take about 7 minutes, hopefully no more than 7 minutes, to say whatever's on their mind. Then I'll ask some questions, then we'll have Q&A from the floor. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Stuart. I'm delighted to be here. For the non-economists in the room, this panel may be a little easier on the brain. Although Glenn Lowry is still up here, so I'm a little nervous. He's going to throw an equation out at us. But this is meant to be a broader discussion than the morning discussions, and I found those to be fascinating. For those of us who study affirmative action, this issue seems to come back every decade or so. You may remember, and each time it manages to survive challenge. You may remember the angry white males in the 1994 election that brought Newt Gingrich in, and a lot of people thought affirmative action would end there. It did end in California a couple of years later. But Bill Clinton had Mend It, Don't End It, which allowed affirmative action to survive at that point. Then in 2003, you had the Grutter case out of the University of Michigan. And again, many people expected affirmative action in college admissions to end because Justice O'Connor had not been a friend of affirmative action in the past. And yet she extended the ability of universities to use race in admissions for at least 25 years, or so we thought at the time. Now in 2012, there's the Fisher versus University of Texas case, which I think may end the pattern by which affirmative action manages to survive, and because of one key difference. So in the past, affirmative action survived barely because Americans are torn over the issue, and the Supreme Court is torn over the issue. On the one hand, you find very few people who like the idea of racial preference, like the idea of deciding who gets ahead considering things like skin color or ethnicity or national origin. That goes against the American grain. On the other hand, most Americans of goodwill want our universities to be diverse ethnically and racially, and there's some evidence to suggest economically as well. And up until now, the trump card that supporters of affirmative action always had was that you cannot achieve racial diversity without using race. Going back to the famous Bakke decision in 1978, Justice Blackmun said, I suspect that it would be impossible to arrange an affirmative action program in a racially neutral way and have it successful. To ask this to be so is to demand the impossible. In order to get beyond racism, we first must take account of race. There is no other way. But in the current case, in the University of Texas, the challenge to the University of Texas, they did find another way. So many of you may know at the University of Texas they have two programs of non-racial affirmative action that they used between 1996 and 2004 and actually continue to use today, throwing race into the mix as well. So the first program is a socioeconomic affirmative action program. So they give a leg up. Let me get the language right here. They look at grades and test scores in the context of special circumstances, which include, quote, socioeconomic status, whether the applicant is from a single-parent home, language spoken at home, family responsibilities, socioeconomic status of the school attended, and average SAT or ACT scores of the school attended in relation to the student's test scores. So that's their one race-neutral affirmative action program. The second, which has gotten a lot more attention, which you probably already know about, is one in which students who are automatically who are in the top 10% of their high school class in Texas are automatically admitted to UT Austin, which effectively allows students to who have lower test scores to be admitted, who otherwise might not be. Now, these two programs, in 2004, when Texas was temporarily banned from using race, produced a freshman class that was 4.5% African American and 16.9% Hispanic. This was higher than the rates of admission using race in 1996, when the percentages were 4.1% African American and 14.5% Hispanic. So it seems to me the good news here is that Texas didn't just give up on diversity altogether. They provided these two race-neutral alternatives and managed to produce considerable racial diversity, racial and ethnic diversity, in fact, marginally greater than they had using race in 1996. Now, I want to acknowledge that's in part because there's been a change in the demographic situation in Texas, but the Supreme Court in the past hasn't looked at the larger demographics of the state. They look more precisely at the question of whether there is a critical mass of students of color who will help inform the education of others in the school. And so they were able to get a critical mass in Texas. Texas is not unique in, on October 4th, the Century Foundation, where I work, is going to be releasing a report looking at seven states that have been banned from using race. And in most of those states, they were able to achieve a critical mass of students, or at least to match or exceed the levels that they, through race-neutral means, that they had achieved using race in the past. Rick Sanders is going to be there at this forum, and Ward Connerly and Lonnie Guineer. So there'll be some interesting fireworks. Now, significantly, in Texas, they did a number of, and in these other states, they did a number of things that progressives like me you know, okay, I'll call, you know, liberals like me, I'll admit it, are normally supportive of, right? So they gave a leg up to low-income students. They increased financial aid for students. They got rid of legacy preferences in three instances, those preferences that go to the children of alumni. So they didn't want to look hypocritical. So in other words, I think that if we do see a curtailment of the use of race in Fisher, there are alternatives out there that we can look to. Okay, so I've got 1 minute. Let me wrap up here. Glenn Lowry has made the important point that this is not a particularly efficient way of getting racial diversity if your sole concern is with getting race and ethnicity, getting a certain representation based on race and ethnicity. But as I say, I think these are good things that it will push universities to look more broadly at the class dimension that's been missing so far. Let me end by suggesting that this new affirmative action, what I think is a better affirmative action based on class or economic status, has important and honorable roots. So this is the 1964 book from Martin Luther King, Why We Can't Wait. And King was torn, as many of us are, about the issue of affirmative action and said, we do need to address our egregious history of discrimination. So he writes, the nation must not only radically readjust its attitude toward the Negro in the compelling present, but must incorporate in its planning some compensatory consideration for the handicaps he has inherited from the past. For it is obvious that if a man has entered in the starting line in a race 300 years after another man, the first would have to perform some impossible feat in order to catch up to his fellow runner. So that sounds like the traditional support for race-based affirmative action. But then King, instead of arguing for a Bill of Rights for blacks, suggests that we need a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged of all races. And he says, while Negroes form the vast majority of America's disadvantaged, there are millions of white poor who would also benefit from such a bill. It is a simple matter of justice that America, in dealing creatively with the task of raising the Negro from backwardness, should also be rescuing a large stratum of the forgotten white poor. Now, almost 50 years after King wrote this, it seems to me that we may finally be headed in that direction. But ironically, in order to get universities to care about socioeconomic diversity, it may be that a conservative Supreme Court curtailing the ability of universities to use race will bring about this vision of an affirmative action program that really reaches out and helps the disadvantaged students of all races. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Glenn, you're next.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Richard, for making that point that I would have otherwise had to make, that the 10% plan and other such schemes which move toward achieving diversity in a non-explicitly racially biased way by introducing devices into the admissions process that can have the predictable consequence of yielding more black and Latino students without separating them out for a different and lower admission standard also has the consequence of changing the criterion for selection into the university population of every single person who is selected, and in view of the fact that the underrepresented minorities are indeed a minority of the overall student body, the consequences for selection efficiency of allowing representation goals to drive the general criteria used to select students can be very deleterious to the efficiency of the selection. And this brings me to the larger point that I'd like to emphasize at the outset here, which is that there's one debate and that's about the instruments used by the institution to select students. Are they to be colorblind? Is it legitimate that they be explicitly racially discriminatory and so forth? There's another debate about what the objectives of the institution should be with its admissions practices. Also, for example, should we even care about the racial composition of the student body at the school? Those are distinct things. One can be blind without being indifferent to the race of the students who attend the school. Blindness would govern the criteria for selecting students. We don't introduce explicit racial discrimination into that process. That would be blindness. Indifference would be the position that there's no moral significance to the racial composition of the school. And the only thing that I would like to ask here is that we have those conversations and we keep them clear. We don't allow judgments about one to implicitly drive our view about the other. So, for example, if the empirical research shows, as it seems to me it is coming to show, that some of the negative consequences for minority students from racially explicit admissions policies are larger than many of the advocates for affirmative action had thought them to be, that's a very important finding, and it ought to feed back to affect the way in which universities conduct their affairs, or perhaps even the way in which courts make judgments about the propriety of universities' conduct. But it doesn't reach the question of what our goals should be in terms of the racial impact of what it is that we're doing in higher education. Okay, I want to hold out for this idea that there is, apart from the imperative of a narrowing of class differences of opportunity in the society, an independent, historically justified, morally compelling imperative to address the problem of the legacy of racial subordination and racial discrimination in the society. When our most prestigious institutions, which are venues for globally significant affairs and are a window onto our society, are devoid of the active and effective participation of people of color, of blacks and Latinos, in our institutions, that's a bad thing for us, especially given our history. So I'm now talking to you about what we should be trying to achieve with our admissions policies, not about the propriety of particular policies or about the effectiveness of particular policies. I'm talking about the goal, and I'm making a plea. Okay? Let us not allow the adversarial process in which a court proceeding is necessarily embedded to cause us to forget the unfinished business, even now, nearly a half century after Martin Luther King Jr. wrote those words, of dealing with the consequences of our racial history. Okay, so that's the end of that. Now, I have a couple of other points that I'd like to make in my remaining 3 minutes. And if I go over by a minute, I'm sure that Rick is going to allow that. I want to remember here my wife, Linda Datcher Lowry, who died literally 1 year ago tomorrow from breast cancer and who was a pioneer researcher in this field. Her 1995 Journal of Labor Economics paper on the mismatch problem in higher education, written with David Garman, was a breakthrough and pioneering paper. I'm really very proud of her, and it just seems a shame not to mention her in memoriam at this time. She should be standing here and not me. Everything I know about mismatch, I learned from her. That's my wife, Linda. Thank you for indulging me with that. Now I just have a couple of more points that I'd like to make. I was struck by the intervention of the young man who has an immunology PhD from Stanford and who did his undergraduate work at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, that intervention being to the effect that, in addition to asking questions about the characteristics of individuals and how they fit with an institution and how they're correlated with the outcomes associated with affirmative action programs, we can also ask about the extent to which there exists modifications or extensions of the pedagogic methods that are used to prepare students for these careers that might be particularly effective at abetting the success of underrepresented minority students. In other words, you can think about affirmative action purely in terms of this individualistic competition. Many want to come. Only a few can be accommodated. Which ones do we admit? And then we can jigger that process in order to favor or disfavor this or that group. Or you could think about affirmative action as posing a challenge to the institution. We lack the extent of racial diversity that would be best for our pedagogic or for our civic responsibilities and so forth. Not enough blacks and Latinos being trained at our institution. Can we rethink what we're doing in some more systematic way or integrate what we do into what might be done elsewhere at other points in the supply chain so as on net to have a more effective outcome in terms of increasing the number of underrepresented minorities who succeed? That's a different kind of question, and it challenges the institution in a different way. My time is up, so I'll end with an anecdote. Somehow I don't think I got as much time as the other guy, but anyway, I'll end with this anecdote. Way back when I taught at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and we were doing affirmative action, and that was in my neocon phase, I must say, my colleagues there entertained the possibility of hiring a black lecturer who was going to be a practitioner in the public health field. And an applicant came from a large state where he had been serving as the director or commissioner of public health for this large state. He gave a talk with PowerPoints. And his I's were not all dotted, and his T's were not all crossed in terms of the statistical inference and the quantitative aspect of what he was doing. And yet, he'd been running a statewide agency and had a tremendous amount of ideas about how to do that well and how to reach these people in these inner-city communities and how to deliver public health more effectively. At the end of the presentation and then in the faculty deliberation afterwards, we decided to make him an offer. And I objected on the grounds that we were making him the offer for the wrong reasons. My colleagues were holding their noses and saying, even though he doesn't meet our typical standards of, you know, analytic precision and whatnot, he's black and we need more blacks around here and let's make him an offer. And my objection was, that man just gave a talk that ought to cause all of us to think really, really hard about what a public policy school is about and how it can be most effective at meeting its objectives and whether or not the mix of people that we have in our faculty is suited to that mission. This guy, who was a practitioner running a public health thing in a state, had been thinking really hard about a lot of things that we more pointy-headed academics didn't give any thought to. And one could have asked the question of a public policy school, does the lack of having African-American lecturers on our faculty reflect perhaps not only the deficiencies of the population of African-American would-be lecturers who apply to us, but also to some degree a miscalibration or misdirection of the very enterprise that we're running here, which should be thought about a little bit differently. Okay? So here's what I'm trying to say, and I know I'm past time. In my ideal world, the questions of affirmative action would not be rightly put and answered only by asking the kinds of questions which this fine conference is devoted to asking and answering about individual impacts. It would also include reflection at the level of institutions about whether or not the way in which they conceive their mission overall and conduct it is compatible with the larger social objectives of narrowing the differences and rectifying the historical consequences of racial discrimination. And I think the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, gives us one kind of answer to that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. Now we'll hear from Professor Phil Richards.
Can people hear me in the back? I'll just shout. Am I fine? Okay, fine. That's fine. Thanks a lot. you know, I think it's right that economists should dominate this conference. There are a lot of misconceptions about affirmative action, as Professor Lowry's and Fryer's clarifying paper show, and I think the macro view, which we are getting in this conference, is particularly useful for sorting out the complexities of this subject and making us think more rigorously about it. You know, I'm an English professor, and my expertise is 25 years of professorship at Colgate University, and my plea of evidence is not a peer reviewed journal, at least not peer reviewed in the sense that is meant here by professional economists. But I do want to say that individual institutions have cultures, and that in my 25 years, I've watched the mismatch develop a culture of inequality. And that culture of inequality is played out in very explicit ways, which is that blacks don't turn up in calculus courses or physics courses or chemistry courses, that I have not seen a Afro-American proceed directly to medical school, and I rarely see blacks in the foreign languages, that I don't really see Afro-Americans in the fields that demand the kind of high-powered analytic and synthetic cognitive skills which are central to performing in a restructured economy. I often find myself advising Afro-American women who are coming into the English department because they can't meet the chemistry, math, physics requirements of pre-med. And I'm not in a position to tell them that they should leave Colgate immediately and they should go to one of the SUNY schools that has programs for students who are interested in not only pre-med, but in other health fields that they might succeed in, be very prosperous in, and perhaps even go to pre-med, go to medical school later on. And I talk extensively over the last 25 years to my colleagues in the sciences, and they tell me explicitly that we take students who, although they are in the top 10 or 20% of boys' high school, don't meet the challenges or don't have the abilities to meet the challenges of science programs that are designed to weed out pre-med candidates who've gone to Shaker Heights High or Hotchkiss, and that they know that they need at least a two-year program to learn basic computation and college algebra and trigonometry before they learn calculus. And yet our department starts at calculus. And so what's developed in the culture of the school that I see is the secondary meaning of diversity that everybody snickers at, which is basically a two-tier system of racial inequality that reproduces the notion of black intellectual inferiority. Schools reproduce social structures and reproduce knowledge. Knowledge has social structures and social knowledge, and it's not hard to figure out the social knowledge that's being reproduced here. And I dare say it's not hard to say that that social knowledge is very evident when someone like Governor Romney says that he wishes that he were a Latino. I myself wish that I were Governor Romney.
Not really.
I've written for commentary, I don't know. But that was before the switch. I'd like to double back, even though I'm making a kind of, ethnographic journalistic account of my experience here. And I certainly can't offer it as a paradigm for all universities, although I think people can recognize elements of this paradigm in many integrated schools and within the profession at large. I mean, I believe in very deep ways that this inequality has exacerbated disciplinary trends to the racialization of knowledge in law, in religion, in literature, where we have people creating canons based on race. I mean, it's not hard to see the racialization of knowledge throughout the culture, and it's not hard to see the symmetry of that racialization to the racial inequalities that are being discussed here. I know I only have a minute here, but Glenn got more time. And I'd like to say that I know I'm in English, but I'll be asked for a policy consideration anyway, which is that schools who want to practice affirmative action are going to have to find compelling reasons, compelling interests, to offer the kind of remediation that their students need in order to participate legitimately in the intellectual life of the school. If schools can't find those compelling interests and reasons, then I don't think that any affirmative action plan will work. I'm not sure that legislation can defeat the ethos of an educational institution, which is maybe the one insight that I, as a fuzzy-minded humanist, can offer. The second point is that what's at stake is not only the opportunities of minorities, but also their human capital. I mean, the black students who are in the bottom of the class at Duke are still strong students from the black population as a whole. They're still part of a mobile group of black people who are largely imprisoned and who are largely marginalized from this society. I think that one of the things that's happening is that we're reproducing inequalities through the limitation of the opportunities of middle classes who've bought the ideology of meritocracy in America, who go to the best schools and expect to do well in the highest majors. And we've created something that is deleterious to that middle class. I mean, I think the black middle class has a deep interest in learning how to make intelligent market choices about its selection of schools and professional training. And what's ultimately at stake is the human capital of that middle class, not just how much money they're going to make, but how much worth they are in American society, their ability to accumulate property, their ability to pursue their own interests, and I think ultimately their position in the American social contract. I think that the same thing goes for the lower 10% too. What's at stake in these discussions is the human capital of the lowest part of the American and most mobile disadvantaged middle classes. And I think that this is an important moment, even from my somewhat marginal point of view. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Phil. I saw nothing marginal about that. And from now on, we'll hear from Peter Schmidt.
Hello. I'd like to thank the Brookings Program for hosting this event and Rick Sander and Stuart Taylor for the role in organizing it. Well, I don't think we're going to settle the debate over the educational impact of race-conscious admission policies anytime soon. It's always worthwhile to have this discussion. In the interest of time, I'm told you've all been given zip drives as some background information, and I want to just briefly go over some clips that I've included in that. Several have come from what I've come to think of as a brief golden era of research on diversity and racial preferences. The period after the Supreme Court handed down its 2003 Grutter and Gratz decisions involving the University of Michigan's race-conscious admissions policies, and before anyone had any idea that a Texas student named Abigail Fisher would file a lawsuit that would reach the Supreme Court and leave the future of such policies in question once again. I call this a golden era because people during it thought the question of the legality of such policies was largely settled, and they felt comfortable producing research that took a nuanced, realistic look at such policies without worrying so much about the potential impact of their findings on public opinions or the conclusions of the court. Their focus was not on changing people's minds, but in determining what policies actually work and have educational benefits. You'll find in your zip drive an article called "New Research Complicates Discussions of Campus Diversity in a Good Way." In it, some researchers who have been quite supportive of race-conscious admissions policies and had a hand in arguing in support of such policies in the Grutter and Gratz cases acknowledge that they're under pressure to skip the nuance and produce sound bites that would help Michigan's case. This clip and others in your package will show that researchers who had supported Michigan became comfortable once the Grutter decision was rendered in saying that diversity only sometimes produces educational benefits and only if handled in the right way with the right mix of students. Heavy-handed policies that send the entire student body a signal that the admissions office substantially lowered the bar for diversity's sake often serve to stigmatize even the most bright and talented black and Hispanic students on campus, undermining their performance in race relations. Not all of the studies covered in these clips support the conclusions put forward by researchers here today. You'll find, for example, a 2005 clip on research from Douglas Massey of Princeton and Mary Fisher of the University of Connecticut, which disputes the mismatch hypothesis and argues that black and Hispanic students who got the biggest break at admissions actually do better than others. I'm not going to settle these questions here today or anytime soon, but you have to say arriving at the truth has become a much more daunting task now that the pending Supreme Court decision has left the issue politicized once again. On that note, I want to point your attention to another clip based on coverage of the 2010 National Conference of the American Educational Research Association, a group that has weighed in on behalf of the University of Texas in the Supreme Court, with a brief that claims research overwhelmingly supports race-conscious admissions policies. At the time the 2010 meeting was held, Arizona had just passed a controversial new immigration law, and the AERA's leadership and many of its members were mounting an effort to produce research showing that the law had negative consequences. When I wrote the piece I'm referencing, questioning whether a group that claims to value objectivity should be championing research for the sake of advocacy, I was told that I was naive to think educational researchers would do anything else. We are now again, alas, in a period where the line between objectivity and advocacy has become blurred, where researchers are less focused on finding the truth and on changing minds. While I won't pass judgment now on the research discussed today, much of which I've not had a chance to read thoroughly or run past potential critics, I will note that critics of race-conscious admissions policies have themselves at times been guilty of producing shoddy studies or using spin to advance their cause. I would like to also throw out the idea that both sides of this debate show some bias in terms of the questions they ask. I see few, if any, studies questioning whether mismatch may occur or students might otherwise be harmed when colleges substantially lower the bar for athletes or legacies or applicants connected to big donors or wealthy politicians or valued faculty members. I see very little research on the question of whether the educational environment benefits from socioeconomic diversity, even though I see plenty of research showing that students whose families lack cash or connections are increasingly being squeezed out of our selective colleges. I recognize that the legal questions before the Supreme Court are distinct in that they deal with the nation's history of racial discrimination and the special focus of our law on preventing racial discrimination. But if we look beyond these legal questions and at the basic values that cause people to care about the Texas case, I'd like to look beyond them at these basic values. Many people here espouse a belief in meritocracy, but no matter what happens in the Texas case, college admission systems will remain far from meritocratic. People might have different concepts of fairness, with some saying it lies in treating everyone the same, others saying it lies in accounting for disadvantage to level the playing field. But by either definition, college admissions policies remain far from fair. And they will remain far from fair no matter how the Fisher case is decided. People claim to champion social mobility, but selective colleges are thwarting social mobility with their policies. In upholding the Michigan Law School's policy in her Grutter decision, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor spoke of the need for a path to leadership to be open to everyone, regardless of race, so that our leaders are seen as having legitimacy. But there's plenty of reason to believe that the path is not open and confidence in our nation's leadership is at a low. It saddens me that the debate over race-conscious admissions has taken our eye off the bigger picture, and I'd welcome more research looking more broadly at policy questions related to how college admissions can be made more open and fair. Thanks.
Thanks to all our panelists for stimulating remarks. I'm going to ask some questions in the order in which the panelists spoke, and then at about 1:15, if not sooner, I'll invite questions from the floor for as long as everybody wants to stay and can stay. So my first compound question, Richard Collenberg, is for you. It's three-part. One, I'd love to hear you elaborate on what you were saying toward the end about how curtailing use of race might actually increase outreach to the disadvantaged. Why is that? How would that work? Second, I've heard the Texas Top 10% plan and similar plans attacked on at least a couple of grounds. One is that it creates worse mismatch problems than traditional affirmative action because the ninth percentile kid at the worst high school in the state may be less prepared than the 11th percentile kid at the best. And what about that? And also, what about, there's a view of some people that that there's a constitutional problem there, too, since the entire purpose of these 10% plans is to increase the number of racial minorities. Take those in whatever order you like.
Sure. The research suggests that universities, for a variety of reasons, care about racial and ethnic diversity. And I think that's a positive thing about our university system. For a complicated set of reasons, universities appear not to care much about economic diversity. We put out a study a few years ago that found that rich kids outnumber poor kids by 25-1 on the nation's most selective 146 campuses. That would not be tolerated with respect to race. You would not see an enormous disparity like that. It may be that universities are more cognizant of race because it's more visible and they are more easily embarrassed by lacks of racial diversity than there are economic diversity. Studies by Bowen and others have looked at the weight that's given to various disadvantages. There are large preferences based on race. Basically, there's no preference given for socioeconomic disadvantage. And the one set of exceptions are in those universities that are barred from using race. because, so the, in other words, when a university is barred from using race, it will look to socioeconomic disadvantage as a way of indirectly creating racial diversity. And so for those of us who care about both racial and economic diversity, ironically, a Supreme Court decision which curtails the use of race may have the effect of forcing those universities that want to continue to use, to achieve racial diversity to bring in lots of low-income whites and Asians as well, which I think is a positive thing, and also to reach out to many more low-income African Americans and Latinos who, for the most part, do not benefit from current racial affirmative action programs. 86% of the African Americans at the selective colleges are middle class or upper class, according to Bowen and Bach. Now, the whites are even richer. But the point is that if universities cannot use race explicitly, that will force them, if they continue to care about racial diversity, it'll force them to do some things that I wish they were doing anyway with respect to economic disadvantage. So that was your first question. Your second question had to do with Texas and the whether there'd be an mismatch problem there. And the research that I've seen from Princeton and elsewhere has suggested that the top 10% students have done quite well. I don't know whether the research has looked at this secondary question of whether they're switching majors. But in terms of graduation and retention rates, I think people have been pretty pleasantly surprised that those students who were in the top 10%, and so basically whose SAT scores and ACT scores were ignored, right? They're automatically admitted based on grades, that they've done much better better than expected. In terms of the legal question, I can speak more forcefully with respect to the economic disadvantage. You know, the Supreme Court has long held that race is held up to strict scrutiny, so you need a compelling purpose and you need to narrowly tailor your means. It's a hard test to meet. Economic differences are subject to the most relaxed form of judicial scrutiny, rational basis. And so, for example, there's no legal problem with a graduated income tax in this country where rich people pay a higher marginal rate than poor people. There might be a very big legal problem if African Americans were had a different marginal rate than whites or Latinos. It becomes a little bit more muddy if your purpose is explicitly race, but even in that case, Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, the two most conservative justices on the Supreme Court, have said that they affirmatively favor class-based affirmative action. And part of the reason is that they indirectly know this will produce racial diversity. So I don't think that the class-based program, at least, would have any serious legal challenges.
Thanks very much. Glenn, I'd like to ask you, I'll go with two parts for now. Have universities, in your view, responded candidly and constructively to the evidence of the costs of affirmative action to intended beneficiaries and others? And number two, to what extent does the kind of diversity value, if I may call it that, that you were referring to of this kind of having racial diversity, different, you know, the white and Asian kids learning from black and Hispanic kids from different backgrounds, to what extent does that hold true given what Richard said about most beneficiaries of affirmative action admissions being relatively well off economically?
Okay, university candor and how much real diversity. Can I, what I'm going to do first is just say a little bit about what Richard just said, because I don't agree that a class-based system will generate a great deal of racial diversity. I would like to see the numbers on that. And what gives me pause is recognition of the fact that the achievement gap, the racial achievement gap in secondary education is especially large amongst low-income African-American students. I can recall back in the 90s during the heyday of all these debates, people quickly pointing to the fact that middle-class and upper-middle-class African-American families were generating students with SAT scores comparable to, at the median, the scores that were being generated by lower and lower middle class white families. So if that's true, the disadvantage of low income African Americans in terms of their academic achievement will leave them very poorly placed to compete effectively against low income whites. So I'd just like to see how that's going to work. It looks like to me.
Can I just jump in for a second, Glenn? Just,
yeah.
And then we'll come back to you.
Fine.
So I think how you define economic disadvantage matters a great deal. So if you look at income, it is true that low-income African Americans are scoring lower than low-income whites, but that doesn't recognize the full complexity of the economic disadvantage that, in the aggregate, African Americans face. So African Americans are much more likely, controlling for income, to have lower net worth. So the wealth gap between African Americans and whites is, African Americans make 5%, have 5% of the wealth of whites, 60% of the income. So if you looked at wealth, that would have a disparate impact, a positive disparate impact on students of color. If you look at concentrated poverty, that would make a big difference. So poor whites are much more likely to live in middle-class neighborhoods.
Okay, I got the point, yeah. Richard, and this is my time.
Yeah.
I got your point, and thanks for the intervention, because this is just going to make my point again, because look at what's going on here. We're searching for proxies for race in the definition of economic disadvantage. So we're still looking for race. We're just not wanting to say that that's what we're looking for without meaning to impugn your motive. But I'm just saying, I can define disadvantage in 100 different ways. And based on how I define disadvantage, so a person has all these different characteristics, and I can create a disadvantage index weighting these characteristics in a lot of different ways. Family income, single-headed family. How about if the father wasn't at home? Okay, that's disadvantage. Okay, that's going to have a big racial kicker.
Right.
Concentrated poverty in urban city. What zip code did you live in? Okay, I can get a lot of race traction out of that. So I'm going to define disadvantage in this way or that way. But how I define it is going to be driven by my forecast about how that definition will generate racial diversity. So I'm still looking for race without saying that I'm looking for race.
Or by fairness, that you know, those are real obstacles. If you have low wealth, if you live in a concentrated poverty neighborhood, there are some whites who live in concentrated poverty. They would benefit from. So it would have a big racial impact.
My point here is this: there is no objective definition of disadvantage. And to the extent that the criterion that is used to implement a disadvantage-based program is calibrated with the idea in mind of achieving racial representation, we're still doing a 10% plan kind of thing, which is proxying for race by changing the significance that we give to non-racial factors, which we know to be correlated with race. That's all I'm saying. So, we can do that, and if we're doing it in order as an institution to get around limitations that the court has placed on us, then we're forced to do it. But if we're standing here as scholars trying to think about how do we design an ideal program and what are we trying to achieve, I think we ought to be candid about the fact that we're trying to achieve, in addition to other things, racial diversity. So I'm just going to go back to my remarks before. The mechanism that you use to select is one thing. The goals that you're trying to seek is another. Don't let us throw the racial representation goal out, that baby, out with the bathwater of trying to get non-racially discriminatory admissions practices. Okay, that leads us into...
I'm going to come back on the next
round. Now, let me address your questions, okay? Just very briefly.
Could I come back on the next round of those? Because I'd like to everyone else to get a chance to talk. Well, rest them briefly if you want. If you want, go ahead.
How do you feel about dumb, rich, black?
Dumb, rich, black kids.
There are none.
Do we have them?
Another way of putting that is that if you do the calibration that Rick is talking about, if you do the calibration based on SES rather than race, you may be having a racial agenda. Maybe it's a heavy racial agenda, maybe it's a light racial agenda, but you're clearly going to omit different blacks and Hispanics than you do under current programs. So that's a lot of the nub of, I think, Rick's point. It's not that you just end up in the same place using a less efficient mechanism.
Well, I would imagine it's also part of your point. You correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, and then we'll go back to Glenn's, that there's something to be said for socioeconomic diversity for its own sake, even if the people who benefit from that focus are white or Asian.
Absolutely. And the so the and to go to Rick's point, the profile, I mean, the research we're going to be releasing in a week or so suggests that you can get a fair amount of significant amount of racial diversity using non-racial means. But looking at the aggregate racial numbers masks the fact that it's a very different set of African Americans and Latinos who would benefit. To my mind, the ones who deserve the biggest leg up are those who, you know, actually grew up in a disadvantaged neighborhood and in a single parent household. And that's not who's tending to benefit from affirmative action today.
Now let's move on. Glenn, would you like to address the other parts of my question?
No,
if you remember them, you're a better man than I am.
I want to say just one more thing about this. I want to say no. Here's what I'm saying. You take a disadvantaged African American kid from an inner city public school system and you put him at Brown, okay? And you watch what happens, right? You take an advantaged African American kid who's not at the top of the top of the top, but who went to the New Trier High School in north of Chicago or the Brookline High in outside of Boston or whatever, and you put him at Brown and you see what happens. That latter kid's going to do better than the former kid, okay? That latter kid is better equipped to survive in that environment than the former kid is. Now, if you want to have some black kids at Brown and you don't want to have a complete fiasco in terms of a separate, qualitatively separate intellectual experience for these two kids, you darn well better go for those middle and upper middle class African-American kids, if that's what you want. Now, on the other hand, if you want a program that reflects our ideals about social inequality and that represents how we, you know, which people we should be trying to help, then you might want to do something else. It's the effectiveness of the selection that I'm concerned about. And you interact low class with race, just take a look at the landscape of our public education in this country. You're asking for trouble. This is just my humble subjective opinion. I haven't run any numbers, but I think that there's reason to be concerned along the lines that I'm. And I'm sorry, Stuart, I know I'm not following your program, but.
I know. I just want to jump in.
I didn't
in.
Really
since,
expect
since
you
we're
to.
We're debating this point. I want to jump in on one other point. Low income blacks with high SAT scores are 1/12 as likely to apply to an Ivy League school as high income blacks with the same SAT score.
But how many of them are there?
Well, there are not a huge number, but there are many more than we're admitting. So the point is that you know, there is partly a greater achievement gap with low-income kids. But there's also a lot of diamonds in the rough that are being totally missed by the current system because they're not the focus of admissions officers.
Fair enough. I want to know how many of them there are. I mean, I don't know, but it's it's worth looking at. Okay, very briefly then, Stuart. Heck no, universities haven't been transparent in my, you know, I've been doing this since 1976, so that's getting on 36 years. And it's a striking thing, the lack of transparency in the general university political administrative world about these programs. I mean, this is not news to anybody, right? Because there is scandal that's lurking right around the corner, right? I mean, they didn't want to admit that the Asians were being, you know, discriminated against by these programs until people forced them to admit it by bringing the data out. And to the extent that there are mismatch problems and whatnot, no, university administrations, given my subjective experience without a systematic historical inquiry, haven't been transparent or candid about that. And I just want to make a larger point. There's a really big public goods problem here, what we in economics would call it. Collective action problem, right? Because the individual institution's interests and the social interests are not at all aligned, okay? So, for example, this cascading problem where the top-tier schools can get by because they can get their racial diversity at a relatively low price because they can skim the cream, okay? So they don't sacrifice very much to get their racial diversity, except by doing so, the whole allocation problem in terms of matching kids to schools is thrown way off. And that's because every institution is individually deciding what it wants to do in a rat race type competitive environment. Okay? Another observation along those lines, I've often thought that selection into universities ought to be based not on a forecast of the student's performance at this place, but on a forecast of the value added to the student's performance by being at this place relative to the counterfactual alternative. You guys see this point. I mean, there's a difference between, I mean, I can create a great class if I can get all the great students here, right? But I may be adding very little to what they would have achieved if instead of being here at Harvard, they happened to be at State U. I may be adding very little to that, okay? But my interest is in creating the best class for Harvard, period. That's every institution's individual interest. And the result of that is that they may be maximizing the wrong thing from a social point of view. And there is no center. There is no centralized authority of coordinating decision making that can offset that. So that seems to me is a point worth making.
Thank you.
Finally, on the diversity question, I just want to say this. This is an anecdote, but I think it gets at the point. I'm teaching my undergraduates at Brown, okay? I've got this African-American young man there who went to a public high school in the District of Columbia, okay? And I've got my other black students, and we're talking about affirmative action, and there's mostly white and Asian students in the class because it's Brown, you know. And the black students from the upper class background are, you know, they're right in there about affirmative action, and they're fighting for affirmative action and whatnot. And then suddenly this kid from D.C. raises his hand and he says, oh, we're talking about the special orientation that we have for African-American students at the beginning of the freshman year when they come in. There's like a three-day thing before the school year starts where they go through a like person of color orientation. And he says, oh, yeah, man, I remember that orientation. I remember those black people. He's talking about the other African-American students at Brown. He says, I haven't seen those people since orientation week. I guess they're off skiing with their buddies somewhere. Okay. In other words, he was keenly aware of the fact that racial diversity didn't mean a kind of diversity that he was looking for, because even amongst the African-American students, he was an outsider.
And Phil Richards, my question, three-part question to you, derives a little bit from there. Well, I can remind them of the second and third parts, or they can skip them if they won't want, or they can pick whichever one. But part one is, at Colgate, how many black students truly excel academically? Part two is, if Colgate were transparent about that, would fewer black students choose Colgate? And number three is, how much racial interaction is there among the students at Colgate? How much of this diversity value is actually happening?
Oh, okay, fine. Well, the first question can be answered by the fact that Colgate doesn't keep records. And each time I went to the university looking for records, I was told, they were kind of holding their nose, no, we don't do this kind of thing. And secondly, they don't keep longitudinal records about how well the needy students do as they progress through the school. So if you're looking for a kind of record of what courses they take, what courses they drop, how they switch into majors, then you're not going to find that kind of information. And thirdly, I guess I would say, well, you know, in whose interest is that information? I guess you're kind of driving at that question. Would Colgate, number one, why does Colgate keep doing it over and over and over again? And secondly, would Colgate kids come if they knew, I guess, is the question of, you know, in whose interest is it to hide the information? Obviously, it's in Colgate's interest to hide the information. Clearly, it's not in the kids' interest to hide the information, which means that diversity is in Colgate's interest. Now, in what way is diversity in Colgate's interest, I think? And diversity is obviously, you know, what Glenn was talking about, this three-day kind of period where white people learn how to get along with black people, where they learn how to extend common civility to other people. And it's hard for me to believe that that's socialization for black people. I mean, the majority of Colgate people are upper class white people, and it's hard to believe for me that a racial socialization of that kind would be in the political interest of black people. So why should white people and wealthy white people who make huge amounts of money and drive Acuras all over town don't have the same interest as these kids whose parents may even make $100,000? So I guess the heart of the problem is that diversity as it's defined here is a kind of political socialization that serves another interest. I mean, my thinking, one of the things I notice is culture, black culture. We have a black cultural center, an Atlanta center. We have a black studies center. They all work together. We invite charismatic black speakers. As you can imagine, I'm not welcome in any of those places. But
let me.
What I'm saying is, I'm not really sure that they would be given all this money if they were in if they weren't in the interest of the school. And if black kids knew, I mean, the information we have here about middle class life, about professional life, about how you get the kind of things that Colgate is supposed to be about, then they would have real interest in going. And to the extent that there's a chance that they might have interest and realize that they're being gypped, they'd be angry. And I don't see how resentment cannot play a role, and how the whole business of social control cannot play a role in diversity. You have two really unequal groups of people, one of which has really incredible prospects. I see all of them jogging around DuPont. And another group of people that doesn't. And this kind of social manipulation is very bothersome to me. It's deeply bothersome to me. I've been to Africa. I've seen third world states. It's the manipulation of intellectuals, the manipulation of middle classes. This is all deeply bothersome to me.
Thanks. I have just one last question, one part question, then we'll go to the audience. And for you, Peter, one would think from the 73 briefs filed on behalf of the University of Texas, every major educational group is in it, a gazillion universities are in it. One would think that everyone at the universities is all very happy about the way racial preferences are shaking out. What's, from your experience, how do university faculties or many of the people on them, what do they really think? Are they as enthusiastic as one might think from this universal brief writing exercise?
I'm terribly sorry.
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to speak narrowly of university faculties, I think there is a large degree of support for race-conscious admissions and more broadly for maintaining the status quo in admissions. As Rick has pointed out, when affirmative action goes away, colleges become under pressure to tinker with their admissions in other ways. And you know, when the Grutter and Gratz case came up, there was a lot of talk of legacy admissions, doing away with them. Those discussions threaten the college's bottom line, and they threaten the money going to the faculty and what have you. And, I mean, it's important to keep in mind that among the various, I mean, I actually think of college admissions as basically a two-track system, an insider track and an outsider track, and faculty members are firmly on the insider track. Their own children get preferences in applying, typically because the colleges give them free tuition, and if you've promised somebody free tuition for their children and their children don't get in, especially if there's no reciprocal agreement where the kids can go somewhere else, you have a very unhappy faculty member on your hand. Now, more broadly, of course, I mean, if you look at the success Ward Connolly has had in promoting state initiatives to ban the consideration of race by public agencies, in the public in general, these policies remain quite unpopular. Most of his initiatives have won by a large margin. And so in the court of public opinion, I think race-conscious admission policies, and if you look at polls as well, the race-conscious admission policies are losing. But, you know, campuses, selective college campuses are a skewed sample. It's people who have not been hurt in any way by these policies.
Right. I'd like to invite audience questions and invite and ask that both questioners and the answers be brief. We've slipped behind schedule. We have about 17 minutes left. So, Professor Lempert.
I thought that several of these presentations reminded us of something it's really important to keep in mind, and that is that people on both sides of these debates often share core values, but they think they'll be realized through different policies. And that's why empirical research and sound empirical research is so important. In this connection, just two quick points. One, I think Professor Lowry has the better of the argument, Mr. Kallenberg, that I happen to share your value about the virtues of more class-based integration, if you will, but that does not solve the problem of race-based integration. I think there's a large literature which goes into that, and I think the Texas 10% plan is a particularly good example because it depends on segregation. Depends on a racial situation we'd like to be passed in order to work. And I just don't think it's tolerable to have a situation we depend on for racial diversity that depends on segregation. It is also the case, as I know you well know, that the University of Texas itself has done substantial survey research, and they believe they do not have a critical mass under their prior system, which is why they did add a Grutter system.
Could you bring it to a question so some other people get to ask questions?
One other point.
A question, please.
I'll ask this question then of Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt, your last remark suggested that university faculty support for racial integration was self-serving because of their own kids or because of financial circumstances. Don't you believe that the primary reason why university faculty support affirmative action is because they contain many people who deeply believe in racial equality, who want to see a more integrated society, and want to see more blacks, Hispanics, and minorities use education to succeed in this country?
There's a values element of it, yeah, absolutely. There is, and I'll acknowledge that, but they're not dealing with the cognitive dissonance that would come from seeing their own children affected by it.
Stuart, can I respond to the
sure.
You know, Anthony Carnevale and Stephen Rose at Georgetown did a simulation of what would happen if at the most selective 146 institutions, if you switched from race-based affirmative action to class-based affirmative action. And they did find, so if you admitted students based on grades and test scores, the selective institutions would be 4% combined African-American and Latino. At the time they were looking at the data, with race-based affirmative action, it was 12%. Using class-based affirmative action got you to 10%. So it was a substantial jump from where grades and test scores would get you, but it didn't quite get you to where race would. I mean, kind of by definition, the most efficient and way to guarantee a certain racial result is to use race. Having said that, Carnevale and Rose didn't look at some of the factors I was talking about, like wealth, that could have an enormous impact or positive disparate impact on racial admissions. We know in the seven states where they've banned race, we looked at 10 universities. In seven of the cases, they had the same racial and ethnic diversity or greater levels of racial and ethnic diversity using class and other methods. With respect to the 10% plan, of course, it's based on the fact that the schools are segregated. That's why it has a positive racial dividend. But I spend a lot of time studying K through 12 education, and unfortunately, that problem's getting worse, not better. And so I think that reality can be harnessed to produce a positive racial result in universities.
Stuart, I'd like to throw out a quick point related to the issue of segregation in K-12 education. And that is, I think it's worth looking at the question of how much college admissions policies are actually perpetuating segregation in broader society. It seems to me if you want your child to go to Harvard or Yale or a top college, about the worst thing you could do is move into a setting that is integrated by race and class, and raise your kid in a normal mid-American setting. Their admissions policies systematically reward isolating decisions, decisions to send students to the most elite backgrounds possible.
Phil?
I think that one of the consequences of our local school system is a really radical distribution of wealth when it comes to public schools, that the high-end suburban schools have much more money, can afford much better guidance counselors, and have a much better realistic and more realistic view of this landscape than lower class schools. Actually, very good work was done on this by one of the people in Howard's education department, Carol Miller, who wrote a very good article on high school education counselors in the inner city. Again, knowledge of the landscape is possessed by people who have access to wealth. And I think that this is, I don't think we can avoid this reality in the way money is. If you look at the Washington, D.C. system and so forth, professional people don't send their kids to these schools. I notice now that in the private schools, not only are they asking for huge tuitions, almost as much as the colleges, but they're asking people to will their trusts, put provisions in their trust, to put money in perpetuity from generation to generation to assure money at the top. And so it seems to me that this kind of class is consolidating itself in the most explicit kind of economic ways.
More questions?
Excuse me, but I know we're running out of time, and I have an analytic observation that I'd like to make before the proceedings close, which is this. We've been talking about affirmative action as a policy question in a kind of 0-1 way. You either have it or you don't have it. And I was stimulated by the observation that let's take those numbers at face value. At elite schools, they're getting 12% combined black and Latino enrollment, and without any affirmative action, they'd get 4%. So that's a huge range. Okay. Now, the empirical studies that we've been reviewing here are against a set of data that have been generated by the actual practices of the universities, which are doing, if you will, aggressive affirmative action, aggressive enough to bring 4% up to 12%. But we oughtn't to give a yes-no answer to affirmative action in general based on data that have been generated by especially aggressive affirmative action when the alternative could be less aggressive affirmative action. Suppose they aim for 6% or 7% instead of for 12%. Maybe the ill effects that people have identified in the data would be much more attenuated under that circumstance. So by framing the question as either affirmative action or not affirmative action, we're perhaps biasing the answer against what the relevant alternative might be, which is less affirmative action.
Let me just add a footnote to that and then invite another question. We have a little more time. If I may mention the Sandra Taylor book that's out there, I think it's very consistent with what you're saying in terms of what the effects of the remedies we recommend would be, one of which is transparency and the other which is basically putting a socioeconomic cap on racial preferences. Now, there were at the far back right.
I'm Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity. The largest minority group in the United States now is, of course, not African Americans, it's Latinos. And the fastest growing racial groups in the United States, according to the last census, are Latinos and Asians, who are growing even more rapidly. African Americans and whites are growing at a relatively low level. Americans who are themselves multiracial or multiethnic is growing at a much faster rate than blacks and whites are. Increasingly, we're seeing than affirmative action that displaces Asian kids in favor of Latino kids. My question is, as the face of America changes in this way, does it become harder to defend a legal regime where state institutions, state universities, are sorting people according to skin color and what country their ancestors came from?
Why don't I invite Peter to respond first, since I think he hasn't gotten in quite as few shots as everyone else, if he's so inclined to that, and then anyone else.
I mean, surely it is, as a practical matter, it's going to be more difficult to defend that, if for no other reason, because you get into the whole classification issue. And, you know, how do you deal with students who are multiracial or mixed? Moral weight attached to giving racial preferences in terms of the nation's history, it becomes clouded when you are dealing with, you know, students who've come from Africa or Jamaica or what have you, who now, you know, account for a large share of the black enrollments at these top colleges. So especially politically and somewhat as a matter of law, I think it is going to be more difficult to do that.
By the way, one of those 17 amicus briefs in the Supreme Court against the University of Texas is filed by an Asian American public interest group. I'm not sure I'll have the name correct, and there are several on the other side. But it's I've read it. It's a very powerful brief, the basic argument of which is that Asian Americans are and always have been discriminated against in admissions to American universities, that the reasons change, but the discrimination doesn't. It's quite, and also that when you take away racial preferences or reduce them, the major beneficiaries turn out not to be whites. They turn out to be Asian Americans. Those are the people who are being disproportionately passed over. Now, I think there was another hand back.
Can I answer just two quick points on the growing Latino population? I think as a legal matter does create problems for affirmative action. The first is that the Supreme Court doesn't say, you know, universities should be in some way proportionally representative of the state as a whole. They only say you need a critical mass of students. And as the Latino population grows, it's going to be easier and easier to get a critical mass, whatever that number is, without using a preference. The other is that in the Croson case, which involved contracting in the city of Richmond, the Supreme Court said one of the reasons they were uneasy about affirmative action was that a majority of the city was African American, and that at that point affirmative action looks less like a policy to remedy past discrimination and may look more political. And so as we become a majority-minority nation in the not-too-distant future, that raises legal issues about affirmative action to the extent that the Supreme Court disfavors any program in which a majority is benefiting itself with respect to race and ethnicity.
Now, there was a hand up back there in Roger Clegg's neighborhood. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Tara Dunderdale. I'm a doctoral student at GW in Ed Policy. And full disclosure, I worked for RIC this summer, so I might be a little bit biased in my question. But given that racial preference and affirmative action is ostensibly to overcome historic discrimination and the, you know, structures in our society that disadvantage groups of people, Professor Lowry, I might be misinterpreting your argument, but would you be supportive of similar preferences for other groups that have been historically disadvantaged? So women, LGBT people, gender minorities, having also proportional representation on college campuses?
No. I mean, I'm not against there being women or LGBT people on college campuses, but I wouldn't be in favor of using historical victimization as a basis for expanding the regime of preferences that we're in to be more broadly applicable. I don't personally mainly think about affirmative action in higher education as remedial or compensatory vis-a-vis past historic violation. I mainly think of it as oriented toward the civic goal of creating elites within the society that are racially diverse on behalf of what I think would be a better, social order. That is, elite universities without the presence of African American and Latino students, or with their presence in very much reduced numbers, would be, to that extent, ill-serving the society in the function of producing elite cadres to lead us in a variety of different areas. So I'm looking at it as good for America that there be, at a place like Princeton or Harvard or Brown or UC Berkeley or the University of Virginia or Duke or other places, some presence of people who come from these communities who might not otherwise be admitted if the admissions were based purely on academic characteristics. Am I clear? I'm speaking for myself. I don't see this program as compensating people for having been discriminated against in the past. After all, we're not talking about the same people. I see it as creating elite cadres in the society and wanting them to be racially diverse as a public good.
We're almost out of time. We have 1 minute, and I think that's – I was going to say one more question, one more answer, but then I wouldn't get to say anything. So let me just be brief and say I've learned a lot. I thank all of our panelists, both these and previous panelists, for wonderful contributions. I take full responsibility. If some of you had questions you didn't get to answer, I'm not a good traffic cop at these things. When people are saying very interesting things, I don't like to stop them. But thank you all for coming. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our panelists. Thanks to my co-author, Rick Sander, for putting this together.